From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, why Governor Whitmer is holding off on new restrictions even as COVID-19 cases surge.
You know, at this point, it's more about persuasion than the possibility of punishment.
Then, how the Latinx community in Washtenaw County came together to make vaccines more accessible to their neighbors.
The Latino community, they were relying on information coming from their own countries, and that was even scarier because we were all still trying to figure out what was happening.
And the owner of People's Records digs through the crates to give you some sounds for your weekend listening.
We had different influences in Detroit with jazz music and gospel music that I think give a lot of the music a certain beauty and richness.
Those stories and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, a pair of organizers tell us about the grassroots organizing they've done to make sure Washtenaw County's Latinx community can get vaccinated. That's coming up later in the show. But first, today, Governor Gretchen Whitmer strongly encouraged a two-week halt to some face-to-face school instruction, school sports, and other public activities in an effort to stop the latest spike of COVID cases that's washing over the state's hospitals, even as Michiganders race to get doses of COVID vaccines. Rick Pluta is Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's Public Radio Network, and he's with us now to talk about Governor Whitmer's announcements. Hi, Rick.
Hi, April.
So amid football metaphors galore, what was Governor Whitmer's advice for the state today?
Her advice was to follow the health advice that get vaccinated as quickly as you can. And, you know, in the meantime, stay masked, stay distanced, which is, you know, what she's been saying for a couple of weeks now in lieu of stricter health orders.
She strongly encouraged, those are her words, strongly encouraged people not to dine indoors and not to meet with friends indoors for 2 weeks. She and Dr. Jonah Khaldun, the state's chief medical officer, did encourage people to get takeout, support restaurants as often as possible. But she said that she would not order some kind of shutdown to happen, nor would she ask Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services to consider it. I take it that choice of language was very intentional.
Very intentional and very specific that that the governor said that, you know, the state is following the science in terms of how to manage the spread of COVID-19. And she may have meant less in this context epidemiology than the persuasion research that the more you push some segments of the population to follow state or you know, to comply with state health orders, the more resistance you'll get. In fact, the more likely it might be that you'll get noncompliance. And so, you know, at this point, it's more about persuasion than the possibility of punishment.
Let's just recap where things stand right now. The number of people in Michigan who either have COVID-19 now or have had it is nearly 800,000. The number of Michiganders who've died from the disease is greater than the population of Traverse City. And the governor did indicate that while vaccinations are going at a steady clip, I heard her say that she wanted things to move faster. Did she not?
She definitely did. That right now the state is in a race against fast spreading COVID variants that, that seem to be accelerating at a very, very fast pace. And so it's vaccination and masks and distancing versus the spread of these variants that spread at a much more rapid pace.
Rick, did Governor Whitmer say anything specifically about why she did not issue orders?
She said that she thinks that it's more effective to ask people to comply than it is to order them to comply.
Did you get the sense that Governor Whitmer seemed frustrated or perhaps merely resigned?
Actually, and obviously this is somewhat subjective, I think that the tone that she tried to strike was almost optimistic that we're in this together and this is doable. And she also kind of set some goals. She said that if everybody pulls together and does the things that they're supposed to do, that we could be looking at relaxing some of the standards and letting, allowing more gatherings and things like that happen as soon as May versus having to slog through the summer on this. She said that she did not expect that Michigan would meet the May goal, but she said it's possible.
I think I heard one reporter ask Governor Whitmer why she thought people might comply now if they have been among those who have not complied in the past for COVID restrictions. How did she answer that question?
That she thinks they'll do it because they should do it, and that this is about protecting our elders, that this is about protecting our children, and this is about getting through this and returning to life as normal more quickly than we would otherwise.
Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, a Republican who's been a foil for Governor Whitmer throughout the pandemic and who was part of the lawsuit that challenged her initial health orders, he tweeted a couple minutes after her speech the following: inform, inspire, encourage, trust. For the better part of a year, Republicans have insisted this would be more effective than trying to mandate healthy behaviors. I'm encouraged that the governor seems to have come to this realization as well. Rick, do you think that's what happened? Is Gretchen Whitmer coming around to the ideas that Republicans have been saying, that people shouldn't be forced to wear a mask or keep distant?
Well, yes, but not for the reasons that Mike Shirkey is talking about, that at the beginning, we saw widespread compliance and that it was working to slow the spread of COVID-19, and that if the state had adopted the Shirkey method early on, then things could be worse today than they would be otherwise. But we're in a period, and there's research at the University of Michigan and other places, that this did work early on, but now people have COVID fatigue, that they want to get out and start doing things again, that we're moving into the warmer months. And so it's time to shift into a new type of messaging that doesn't rely so much on government instruction, but on inspiration.
At this time, we've had a sea change in terms of leadership in the Michigan House of Representatives. It's still a Republican, but Jason Wentworth is now the Speaker of the Michigan House. Do you get any sense that either Shirkey or Jason Wentworth have altered their stances on public health restrictions or public health guidance in recent months, as Michigan's been going through this pretty serious third or fourth surge?
Well, as you just said, that Mike Shirkey said that this is the path that Republicans have been wanting for a while. So I don't see why they would make a dramatic shift. I think the big question still unanswered is, will we see in the legislature and the executive branch some way where those two branches come together on a plan to combat the spread of COVID in Michigan while we're ramping up vaccinations, or will we see continued conflict?
I think a lot of people's growing realization that even as vaccinations are spreading throughout Michigan, people are getting vaccinations, that it's not as if health guidance goes away right away. Can you envision in the next legislative session there being more bills related to this topic?
Oh, I think that that's a given, and that even as we're going through this, that we're seeing Republicans in the legislature, in particular, introducing bills to change how we manage crises like this in the future, so that the legislature plays a greater role closer to the front of the crisis.
This concept of asking people rather than ordering them to stay home, do you see this gaining any steam around the state?
It is the new strategy. It is the new plan. And there is a there's research on this that deals with how do you effectively persuade the people who are vaccine reluctant to get their vaccines? How do you persuade the people who aren't really happy with the masking and distancing and getting together with loved one requirements to nevertheless comply with these, with these recommendations? And there's actually a plan. It's called the Protector Coalition, and it speaks to motivations other than complying with health orders, that you're doing this to protect your town, you're doing this to protect your elders, and it's an act of basically patriotism.
It sounds like that's something that might get a little bit more resonance in some of the more rural and more Republican places in the state than those that have been a little bit more on board with restriction and regulation.
Oh, that's exactly who it's directed at, and it's a very sophisticated operation. That we have people who are public health messaging experts who are working with script writers for TV shows to try and create an environment where people are going, yeah, this is something that we should be doing, and that is that's the phase that we're moving into.
Rick Plutus, Capitol correspondent for Michigan's public radio stations. You can watch for his reporting on more of this in the coming days. Hey, Rick, stay safe. Thanks.
Oh, glad to do it, April. You stay safe also.
I will stop short of calling what we're going through right now end times or anything, but I have to say some weird things have been happening among Michigan's bird life. The Charlevoix Courier reported this week that the city's wild turkey population has exploded this spring. Invigorated flocks have been strutting their stuff downtown, and some reports have surfaced of residents getting chased or even jumped by wild turkeys. The city's website says the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is actively seeking a solution and asking people to remove those bird feeders from the backyard for now. Not that anyone asked, but we at Stateside would like to offer a modest proposal. Consider the possibilities of declaring half Thanksgiving, the third Thursday in May. This state seems in desperate need of a holiday. Maybe if we all just took a break and availed ourselves of some wild-caught farm-to-table options, we could help DNR deliver fully baked solutions to the good people of Charlevoix. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. This week, we've been revisiting some conversations that were recognized with a Michigan Association of Broadcasters Award for Stateside in the year 2020. Today, we're going to listen to something many of us miss: the sounds of the record store. Before the pandemic became a long-haul proposition, we were talking with record store owners from around the state to find out what cuts they were listening to. Today, we're going to listen to my conversation with Brad Hales, one of the owners of People's Records in Detroit. People's has been closed since last summer due to the pandemic, and Brad has moved his operation online for the time being. But when it is open, Brad's shop is a crate digger's paradise and a bit of a tourist destination. People's features a lot of music from Detroit originals to rarities of all kinds. Here's our conversation. Could you tell me what kinds of music you find yourself being drawn to these days?
Well, I focus on Michigan music myself, but that could be a lot of different things. And I don't solely listen to music from the state, but everything I selected today is from here. I think if you take a deeper look at it, you can become really obsessed with just studying what happened in this state because it's very rich.
It's got to be said, there aren't that many states in the lower 48 where you can listen local almost exclusively, but Michigan definitely seems like one of them.
A lot has happened here in the, musically, and just it resonates with me because we had different influences in Detroit with jazz music and gospel music that I think give a lot of the music a certain beauty and richness that hopefully you'll hear in some of the tracks today.
I've got to believe having the store in the city, you just have access to people's stories in a way that a lot of other places do not.
We do. It's kind of mind-blowing, the people that might pop through the door sometimes that we get to interact with and hear, you know, what they went through or what they're doing now. You know, it's really interesting. Anybody from Mike Banks and Derek May, you never know, and you might see rock or punk legends, you know, as well around. So it's exciting in that sense that a lot of these people are still out there, you know, walking among us.
What was the first track you brought for us today?
I wanted to talk about Johnny Mae Matthews. I think she's a really interesting figure in Michigan music because not only was she a pioneer as a Black female songwriter, artist, and producer, but she was also the first African-American female record label owner. She owned several record companies, just like Berry Gordy did, and she even started a year before him. And so I think her story is especially important. Most of us know her from the Temptations movie you'd see on TV late at night, where there's this kind of wicked woman who has the Temptations before Motown did and cheats them and buys a Cadillac and then da-da-da.
Sort of playing the Morris Day role in the film.
Yeah, and I believe her family might have even received a settlement for the way that she was portrayed there because it wasn't accurate. She actually was an inspiration and kind of helped these people get to where they eventually went, you know. But she's a fantastic artist, and this is one of my favorite pieces of music of all time. It's I Have No Choice.
Okay, let's listen. Sometimes Johnny Mae Matthews is credited as the person who taught Berry Gordy everything that he knew.
Wow.
About the recording industry. What do you hear in this track that is fundamental to sounds that both she and Berry Gordy were putting out there at the time?
Well, I mean, the elegance of it. This is a new kind of R&B, you know, developing in the 60s that's really lush and beautiful, you know. So, I mean, that's one thing that Motown also had. It was, like, transcendent and maybe the roles that were expected, you know, of Black people. Like, you know, very sophisticated and, you know, and classy, you know, like elegant R&B. So I think that's one thing that they both shared on that track. And generally, her stuff is a lot earthier and more blues-influenced than Motown came to be.
It looks like the second track you brought for us is a really great Stax Records artist, Daryl Banks.
Well, Daryl Banks actually came to Detroit from Buffalo and wound up kind of getting absorbed by the Stax Empire, but was an independent artist here. And he only lived to age 28. The Metro Times featured a piece on Banks about maybe 10 years ago now with his incredible life story. He was shot in an altercation over a romance or a failed romance by an off-duty Detroit police officer.
Yeah, it looks like he seriously got involved with the wrong police officer's girlfriend.
Right. Either way, his life was cut tragically short due to gun violence and this, whatever happened there. And we're left with, sadly, few recordings because many soul fans recognize his single, Open the Door to Your Heart and Our Love is in the Pocket, as being one of the greatest double-sided soul records that ever came out of Detroit, rare or common. It's just such a great song that definitely gave Motown a run for its money, probably using some of their own musicians. The track that I brought today, though, is a special find from this past winter from a man whose father passed away. He was a TV repairman, and he had a habit of buying 45s from people when he went to their homes to repair their televisions. And so when the father passed away, the son brought in the records, and he had this incredible metal acetate. It's a studio reference recording, a one-of-a-kind thing that they might send an artist or producer home from. It's a piece of metal with lacquer that they cut a one-of-a-kind recording home for reference, so you can take it home and listen to it after the studio and see if you like the mix and how it sounds and everything. Or maybe they would give it to a DJ for, to hype it, before the record is released. So anyway, this flaking metal acetate comes in with a new song that no one's ever heard before from Daryl Banks from a year before he passed away.
When the son of the guy who found this record brought in this box of stuff to the shop, what was your reaction?
Well, I knew who Banks was, and I knew that I didn't recognize the song, but it required, a day of working on it to get it to the point that you'll hear in the recording, which this thing was flaking apart. And after I made the recording, the lacquer did flake off. So if this recording wasn't captured in this MP3, this song would have been lost, for all time unless another one surfaces.
That's amazing. Let's take a listen. Daryl Banks, It's Not Fair to Me. Brad Hales, do you know what that instrumentation is there during the break?
We've been trying to guess. People have suggested that it's a bassoon or a bass clarinet, maybe with some kind of effect on it.
I was thinking, is that an oboe? it's not often you hear woodwinds in soul songs.
But it's got some kind of studio treatment on it, maybe an effect or something, like possibly a Leslie speaker or a tremolo or some kind of thing, giving it a strange out-of-phase effect. But it's interesting because on Daryl Banks' studio recordings that were compiled on the Stax LP, they're not psychedelic in any way. So this is kind of like, by this point, you know, it's like the Beatles are happening and soul music is getting affected by the, you know, psychedelic trends of the day. That's something that didn't, you know, happen on the records that came out, you know, during his lifetime.
Given the volume of music that you have in the shop and the number of tracks that are rapidly, we're kind of losing to the ages. Do you ever just wish you could switch careers and become more of a full-time archivist?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot more that that could be done there. But at the same time, Detroit, it's that Daryl Banks track is special because it's one of the only things that you could add. I mean, it's been looked at to death under a microscope by decades from people around the world who are all fascinated. So to find a new recording from the 60s is kind of difficult to do because it's been anthologized to death. But I like just swimming in it and, you know, being active in the community and, you know, circulating this stuff to other people who will, I mean, when you see these kind of records played live for a room full of people that are getting it, it can really, you know, make you feel better. It can improve the quality of life for a whole region, you know. So it's important work to kind of keep that stuff in circulation too, either by playing it out for crowds to dance for it or by getting the records into people's hands.
It looks like the last track that you brought for us is from a DJ that people might know from around Detroit, Jay Daniel. This is called Sundance from a record that he put out on his own Watusi Records label, an album called Tala. You want to set this one up for us?
Yeah. Jay Daniel he's, you know, younger on the end of some of these guys who've had, you know, decades long careers. This record just kind of, I've always thought that he was good, but this one I thought, you know, right away, like, oh, I'll be listening to this for the rest of my life. I mean, what struck me about it was I have no idea how in this day and age someone could make music so calm. So I think he's touched on something really special there because this is only one track out of a four-sided LP, and it kind of maintains the same relaxing quality that definitely takes you someplace else that you want to be.
Was the vibe on this record very far out of Jay's wheelhouse?
Well, the nice thing about it is it doesn't feel necessarily aimed for the dance floor as much as some singles. It's a double album that you want to listen to the whole thing and keep flipping it, not like a single where a DJ would use it as a tool, you know, to, you know, get a certain response from the dance floor. But it's more like something you put on while you, you know, cook dinner and water your plants or something.
The polyrhythm in there is really something.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great layering going on and a lot of stuff that your mind can really engage and escape in.
Do you know if Jay gets a band together for his studio sessions or if he's more of a bedroom producer?
I think this is all him.
Wow. Well, it's just gorgeous. Thanks for bringing it in.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of people are feeling 2020 is a year of many stressors. I don't know that you intended to bring us some songs to help us get centered and find some peace, but it sure seemed like it worked out that way.
Excellent. No, that's something I'm constantly looking for.
What do you tell people when they walk into the store and they're looking for something to just take them out of themselves?
I mean, honestly, I would rather teach someone to fish than fish for them. So my role there is to try to get the things out so you can look at them. And I tell people, here are the listening stations with the headphones. Now get your hands dirty.
Brad Hales from People's Records. I guess I just want to say thank you for your service. We appreciate all the years in the shop and for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Vaccines are now available in Michigan to any adult who wants them. But the fact is that some of the groups hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic are also being vaccinated at lower rates. In Michigan and across the country, both Black and Latinx communities are facing higher rates of infection and death and lower rates of vaccination. A group of community organizers in Washtenaw County set out to change that and to try to make vaccination doses more accessible. With us today are Spring Quiñones. She's an outreach coordinator for the Washtenaw County Health Plan. Spring, welcome.
Thank you.
And Maria Militzer is with us too. She's the president of Mexiquenses en Michigan, a nonprofit that was started by Spanish-speaking parents, which has taken on several different kinds of work and advocacy over the past couple of years. Maria is also a postdoc scholar at the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Maria, it's good to have you.
Hi, everyone.
To start off with, Spring, could you just tell us a little bit about what you observed last year at this time as COVID was starting to spread through the community?
Well, when the pandemic hit and there was all of this uncertainty as to what was this that was striking the world, right? And not having enough information about what was this COVID-19, what was this virus. And as we were trying to grapple with that, you know, the information had to also be translated into other languages, especially into Spanish, because the Latino community, they were relying on information coming from their own countries. And that was even scarier because we were all still trying to figure out what was happening. The thing that came along with the COVID was also the mental strain and the mental anxiety and the fear that was gripping everyone. And what our families, our Latinx community, they already have certain fears about not having the proper documentation, let's say, to be here, expired licenses, or, you know, just that general fear of always being cautious of even taking your kids to school, because that can bring about other actions that could lead to, you know, the worst circumstance, which is, you know, your family being separated.
Right. Well, so with this in mind, could you both tell us what you were thinking about when you started to design the outreach, what it should look like and what it had to help people do? Maria, do you want to maybe start out?
Yeah, well, we came up with a very comprehensive approach to try to support and strengthen the support network that we created since a year ago to support our families in all ways possible. We raised funds from the larger community and the support of local foundations to support families to assist with rent payment and just cover basic needs, to the distribution of PPE and food and groceries, and all, even some financial support to pay for their medications and basic needs for their children, including internet access so that they could connect to their learning virtually.
Keep on with school. Yeah. You know, I've heard some people refer to what's happened over the past year as the omni-crisis. It sounds like that was just as true for the families that you work with as it was for anybody in Michigan. I think a lot of us probably take for granted that we can get on the internet, log into a website to make an appointment. And for many of us, that's going to be in some language that we understand. And some of us have time to wait by the computer for more appointments to open up or check several times a day. And for others of us, this is just not possible. What did you feel like you had to try to do to help people with the technology that is a part of vaccine appointments in so many places?
Access to the systems that were implemented and still are in place require very knowledgeable people to be able to navigate internet systems and register themselves in order to get in line to receive the vaccine. But that's not the case for all community members, and especially when language barriers are up front, we do need to create systems that accommodate every single member, every single resident in our counties, not just a system that will work for the average person. And I'm not talking just about language barriers for the Latinx communities, but also for the African American and / Black communities. Many of our residents face technology limitations and even internet access because of the cost, because of their location, because of different factors that promote these health disparities that we see across our county.
Right. I know that Detroit had some success in getting people on the phone to sign up instead of just giving them a website, giving them a phone number so they could call to schedule. Spring, was that something that was an option in Washtenaw County?
You know, it was heavily geared for the, for the internet, right? Because most people have access on their phones and it's easier to do that. I know that there was a phone line set up that if people press 4, then we had someone from the Washtenaw Health Department answer in Spanish and return phone calls that way. But still the access to the links and access to the whole registration system was still very cumbersome, was still all in English. And so that was a little bit, that was definitely challenging for our community.
Yeah. If people get to the point of being able to get a date and a time when they can show up and be vaccinated, how much of a problem is it for people to get appointments at a time when they can go?
That's a very good question, April, because many of our Latinx and Black and African-American residents work not just one, but maybe 2 or 3 jobs a day. And being available to accommodate the traditional 9-to-5 schedule that most government offices held is very difficult. So creating opportunities to access the vaccine was of crucial importance for the Latinx leaders that are been working really hard for their communities in the last year and a half. Creating the opportunity to get vaccinated after hours when they are done from their daily jobs and don't have to sacrifice work time, which ends up being a limitation in their already very limited income, has to happen.
You've both been involved in public health for a long time. I wonder how you feel the vaccine rollout has been going, perhaps compared with the need in the community.
To me, and many of our community residents, it's not fast enough. It's not flexible enough or accommodating enough. We're starting to work with other clinics in the area so that vaccination can occur more rapidly. People want to get vaccinated. They want to be protected despite all the misinformation out there that contradicts the efficiency and efficacy of the vaccines. They want to protect their families. We just need to create those opportunities, give them access to get vaccinated in a timely manner, especially when we see that the number of cases, the number of hospitalizations and death rates in minority communities is highly devastating compared to other populations, to other segments of the population in Washington County and across the state and across the country.
Yeah. Do you feel like there are certain things that the pandemic has made plain, maybe things that community members themselves were all too aware of, about the limitations of public health and the healthcare system, that you think, you know, if someone asked, how can we improve this, you know, maybe the first things that you would say that the pandemic has highlighted?
I think that right now we are in a time of awareness, of social change, social justice. Everybody's becoming more aware of health disparities. And once we are aware, then we know where we're going and what we could do, right? These create opportunities for health systems and health departments to address these issues. I think traditionally, health departments, you know, they really didn't reflect the community that they were here to serve. And I feel that the, at least here in our county, we are more committed to doing that. We have had opportunities where we have worked with, say, for example, the Latinx community, where we did a health survey a few years ago to really find out what the health needs were of the Latino community. Through there, we've also have formed a Community Voices, which is groups of community members that do meet with staff from the health department to bring forth what the issues are. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done. However, there are steps in the right direction. Definitely, this pandemic really showed the chasm as to who was getting affected most by the virus and such. But I really feel that there is a commitment from the health department to work with our community partners to bridge that. And I think that we are starting with the pop-up clinics, working with groups like Maria Militar Mexiquense, St. Francis of Assisi, where we could have these pop-up clinics occur at churches during evening hours. And this is just the beginning. There are more community partners that we can connect with. So we are very aware of the different health inequities in our county. And we are, you know, I really feel that we are committed to addressing those.
Yeah. Spring, on the one hand, what you're describing, it feels like a very uplifting story about people who came together to make it safer for their families and their neighbors. And on the other hand, it's a story of people who had to do that because a broader system failed them. I wonder if either of you have thoughts on how we reconcile those two sides of the coin.
April, thank you so much for making these comparisons. For a while, I have been thinking, you know, in this effort to plan and implement the pop-up clinics that have been happening, all the heavy lifting to do the registration for folks that are Spanish speakers in order to receive the vaccine, creating a volunteer pool so that bilingual community members can be present and assist nurses in order to get the vaccine and in the arms of people that need them the most has been draining for the community. And I hate to say this, but I see it sometimes as one more manifestation of a structural racism, where it comes to communities to do the heavy lifting to create change for themselves, because the system in place is so much eager to serve the average person that already have access to the other opportunities that many people, communities of color, don't. It's sad, but at the end of the day, if it happened to be the COVID crisis, to see it with our own eyes one more time and seeing people die in such high numbers, to realize that we have to do something, not to get our systems back to where they were before the pandemic started, but completely transform the way we see public health and the way that we practice public health. And that public health is not just about getting vaccines in people's arms, it's about counteracting all these forces in place that keep reinforcing the social determinants of health that are causing all these inequities, starting with the very bad word that we are so scared of saying, but racism is still very much embedded in all points of interactions that we have with communities of color and people with low income and people with low education.
Right. Spring, anything you'd like to add to that?
You know, I work with a program within the public health department, but I know that we are addressing the isms that keep people from living their full, healthy lives, right? And so we have named that racism is a public health crisis, that racism is, you know, we have named it, you know, and I think that once you start to name it and talk about it, and, you know, these are, can be uncomfortable conversations, but these are very important conversations to have. You know, like it's you know, like you see a ballet, right? You come to the or to a show and it's just beautiful and it's flowing and it's graceful, but you don't see everything, the sacrifice, the pain, the tears that went into all those hours and hours and hours and hours of rehearsal. So you may come to a pop-up clinic and see us smiling and excited and grateful that we're doing this, but you are not seeing all the intense hours of volunteers that they themselves are out there cleaning houses, working in restaurants, washing dishes, coming home, getting on their cell phones and returning people's phone calls and registering them themselves to get to these clinics. And so I feel like we need to have more Marias, more Springs.
Yeah.
And, you know, available, you know, we are, the public health system has to reflect more the community. We can't be these unicorns in public health, right? No, this is not, we're not playing doctor here. This, you know, these are people's lives, and it has to take a very strong commitment from, you know, from everyone to, you know, address these health disparity issues in our county.
Spring Quiñones is an outreach coordinator for the Washtenaw County Health Plan. We've also been talking with Maria Militzer, a postdoctoral scholar at the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health at the University of Michigan. She's also the president of Mexiquenses en Michigan, a nonprofit that has been working with Spanish-speaking parents and families in Washtenaw County. Maria, Spring, it's been great talking to you. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. Have a good weekend.